Chapter 15. Changes in the Wind. Sometimes Gordon and I scarcely had time to eat. Back in the Sudan, we'd resumed our busy schedule. New airstrips had been opened up. The authorities in Addis Ababa had given us permission to fly regularly into Ethiopia, and our flying hours had doubled. Phyllis was often left on her own, always with masses of office work and accounts. We'd now made our base at Malakal, living first at the American mission and later at a government rest house at the airport. Even before we'd left for England, it had become obvious that Malakal, not Doro, should become our Sudan base, as Governor John Winder had always suggested. SIM at Doro, still in need of accommodation, was glad to buy and finish our house there. In God's providence, we'd learned much by basing initially at Akobo and then at Doro. We'd seen firsthand how different missions operated and shared in the trials, problems, and needs, as well as the successes of the missionaries themselves. We'd gained invaluable experience in building and maintaining mission station airstrips. I would not have missed those experiences, for they provided a priceless foundation for the years to follow. John Winder still encouraged us to find land and build our own house at Malakal. While in England, we'd contacted an aluminium company producing cheap prefabricated accommodation units. They were relatively crude, small, box-like shells of corrugated aluminium, but we believed they could be made into effective houses. Gifts to the work of MAF having increased, we were able to purchase 3 units and have them shipped to the Sudan. This was timely, because our housing needs were increasing. In March 1953, the plane developed a serious propeller shaft oil leak at NASA and was grounded for several days while I worked on it. We never minded being at NASA, though. The missionaries there always made us feel very welcome. One of them, Jean Maxwell, had actually been born there. Her parents had been missionaries themselves. After qualifying as a nurse, she had returned to NASA to work. Gordon had met Jean a few times before. This time, it was different. He fell in love with her. He determined to tell her before we left. Sunday afternoon was hot. The Sobat River ran right by the mission, and Gordon thought, I'll go for a swim. He was soon midstream and drifting with the slow current. Suddenly he noticed someone on the far side, sitting on a sandbar surrounded by newer children. Who's that? He wondered, then suddenly realized. It's Jean. Here goes. He quickly swam across and sat beside her. Jean, I've fallen in love with you, he said. She was speechless with surprise. It was a one-way conversation, Gordon told me afterwards. Before we left NASA, however, Jean had agreed to write to Gordon, just as Phyllis had done with me. Later, they too became engaged. The similarities with our own engagement were so marked that for a moment I did wonder if missions might see us as robbers of some of their best staff rather than helpers in their work. Maybe Stan McMillan's letter to Norman Nunn wouldn't be seen as a joke after all. I needn't have worried. The intermission marriages only brought us more closely into the mission family. Gordon and Jean had a colourful wedding at NASA, attended by missionaries, local Arab traders in their flowing robes, and Nuas in assorted costume. Many of them had known Jean since she was tiny. Chuck Jordan, the agriculturalist, presented the couple with a bull. No newer wedding would have been complete without it. The next news was that Alistair and Margaret MacDonald were arriving from Thailand. The political situation there had deteriorated and opportunities for MAF were not opening up. It had become clear to them that the greater opportunity was in the Sudan. Alistair had bought a small single-engine plane, a Piper Pacer from an American missionary. Like others of us, he'd used savings from his wartime salary. He flew the plane the 6,000 miles from French Indochina. We were glad to welcome him and Margaret to the Sudan team. Everything was wonderful. Alistair learned Morse, and I initiated him into its use in the air. With two planes, we now had the ingredients for a continuous service. The government had gained such confidence in our operations that they were prepared to let us operate the single-engined Pacer as well as the Rapide. Given this permission to fly single-engined aircraft, we could go ahead with the plan to replace our fabric and wood Rapide with two small, all-metal, American-made Cessnas. These would be more economical and more reliable in tropical conditions. With their large tyres, lighter weight and better takeoff, they'd also perform much better on short, swampy airstrips. It would take time to raise enough money to buy two of them, but that was our target. The Presbyterian and Reformed churches in America, in response to requests from their Sudan missionaries, gave me permission to speak in their churches and seek funds for such a plane. American MAF didn't see this as poaching on their territory. Phyllis and I could at last be released for furlough. Little had Phyllis known when she left home that it would be 6 years before she got back. She was excited and eager for me to meet her family. We were feeling very tired too, but it looked like a full schedule ahead. We knew we needed to spend some time with American MAF near Los Angeles and with mission leaders in New York. It was important to make contact with friends and churches who'd been supporting us personally. And of course, we were keen to take advantage of the opportunity to tell these churches about our need for a Cessna. En route to the States, we were back for a while with my parents in Cardiff. I spent 6 grinding weeks peering through a magnifying glass to edit 3 new MAF movie films from material I had taken during our time in the Sudan. But there were times of refreshment too, as we enjoyed the first spring we'd seen for years. The beautiful woods were full of primroses and celandine. Later there were buttercups, bluebells and daffodils. It was a sight for sore eyes after so many years in the desolate swamps and dry deserts of the Sudan. We felt we were in heaven. Then came the telegram from Gordon and Alistair. Both planes damaged beyond repair at Malakal. It seemed as if the bottom had dropped out of our world. An abnormally vicious storm had struck the airfield with winds gusting up to 120 miles per hour. The planes were torn loose from their tie-downs, the Pacer thrown over onto its back and completely wrecked, the Rapide carried 100 yards before dropping to the ground, breaking its wings. MAF was out of action again at a single stroke. We'd had enough money to buy the planes originally, but not enough this time to insure them against damage. We had lost everything. Now we needed a Cessna even more urgently. It was with heavy hearts we left for the USA. The warm and excited welcome from Phyllis's family did something to lift our spirits. They took me into their hearts and made sure there would be no lack of well-made tea for their English son-in-law. We were exhausted when we reached California, far more so than we had recognized. Looking back, I realized we'd been through a great deal physically, mentally, and spiritually. I found it hard to meet large groups of people in churches. For the first 2 months, I simply wanted to hide, or even to cry. Then, at last, we gradually started feeling more ourselves. It was just as well. There was so much to be done. Correspondence from MAF in London and the Sudan was constant and required carefully considered decisions and answers. Phyllis and I ran a mini office. "Let's go over to MAF headquarters," I said to Phyllis. "We need to meet Grady Parrott." MAF US was only 60 miles from Phyllis's home, so we took advantage of the easy contact. It was especially good to meet Grady at last. He made us very welcome, and we spent long hours discussing many aspects of MAF work. American MAF was very much larger than our group, and now had operations in both South America and Indonesia, regions very different from our southern Sudan swamps. "What do you think now about merging our two MAF groups?" I asked Grady. It was an idea we'd aired in letters once before. With his greater experience, he was cautious. "We concluded there were more problems than advantages in setting up an overarching international organization with its inevitable complications and inherent communication difficulties. We agreed, therefore, to retain our autonomous national identities. We'd each continue to be responsible for our own areas of operation, while still maintaining close fellowship with each other." We had many helpful meetings with Grady over the ensuing years. The planned contacts were made with mission leaders. At the many church meetings, people responded with interest and contributed towards a new plane for the Sudan. Gradually, funds accumulated, though nothing like the £6,000 needed for a Cessna, an astronomical sum in our eyes at that time. Meanwhile, God had his own ways of keeping our Sudan operations going. We hadn't been in the USA long before SIM offered to buy a replacement Rapide, to be owned by them, but operated by us. They wanted our service resumed without further delay, otherwise some of their missionaries would be stranded, and the government might demand their withdrawal from the more isolated areas. Gordon and Alistair traced a Rapide in East Africa, which SIM bought, and MAF resumed intensive flying. Then they heard of an old wartime RAF blister hangar standing idle in the desert at Wadi Halfa. After some hard bargaining, the government sold it cheaply. Alistair went north and supervised its dismantling, shipping, and eventual reassembly at Malakal. Although open at both ends, it gave considerable storm protection, as well as shelter from the sun and rain. It proved invaluable too, for routine maintenance, which, until then, we'd had to do in the open. The McDonalds and Marshalls had been living in unsuitable and uncertain rented accommodation. During our absence, they had to move 7 times. MAF urgently needed a site to erect its own houses. News came of 3 adjacent building plots to be auctioned in Malakal, ideal for our proposed new base. Unfortunately, there was a lot of local competition for them, from well-to-do Arab traders, and particularly from a wealthy newer politician. If they all turned up at the auction, the price could soon soar beyond our slender means. On the auction day, there was a heavy tropical storm. Everything stops in Malakal when it rains like that. But, soaked to the skin, Gordon and Alistair arrived at the provincial headquarters at 10 a.m., the appointed time. The Sudanese district commissioner, who was to conduct the auction, was there. The newer politician was not. "I'll wait 10 minutes because of the rain," said the DC. But only one other person, a lone Arab trader, appeared. The auction was brief. The 3 plots went to MAF at the reasonable price of £125. Just as the proceedings closed, the politician arrived. Too late. In spite of a heated argument, the DC held firm. The 3 plots have been sold to MAF. Gordon and Alistair hired local labour, and like other missionaries before them, started to learn new building skills. Further good news arrived a little later. SIM's general director, the helpful Mr. Playfair, wrote, saying they now wished to make the Rapide a gift to MAF. Shortly afterwards, the American Mission Home Board offered a large donation towards the purchase of the first all-metal Cessna. We rejoiced again. From the USA, Phyllis and I returned to England. There, to our delight, God gave us our first child, Rebecca Ann. When we got back to Khartoum in August 1955, Norman and Matty Nunn at the SIM headquarters gave us a warm welcome, with a room and a crib all ready for Becky. We felt we'd come home again. The loving fellowship of our Christian friends in the Sudan had not changed. The political climate, however, had changed a great deal. The old Anglo-Egyptian Sudan was moving rapidly towards independence, but all was not well. A garrison of southern soldiers mutinied against their northern Arab officers, whose dominance they'd begun to fear, killing over 100 Arab soldiers and traders. Northern troops retaliated. The mutiny was suppressed and its leaders executed. The remainder of the garrison fled into the bush and formed a guerrilla force. Some southerners wanted secession from the north and an autonomous, independent south. Others would have accepted a federation whereby the south could look after its own affairs whilst remaining part of the whole Sudan. The ruling northern government, however, wanted neither. They declared a state of emergency in the three southern provinces, including the Upper Nile province where we were based. Fervent Islamic elements took the opportunity to assail Christian work. The Arabic press blamed missions for causing the trouble, claiming that the teaching of Christianity had alienated the previously animistic southerners from the Muslim north. When we got to Malakal, we found that the Marshalls and McDonalds had almost finished building the first of the prefabs and organised it for us to live in, our first home. The McDonalds then went on furlough, and I immediately joined Gordon in flying the Rapide. Whenever we weren't flying, we were building our base. When we were flying, it was our wives who supervised the building crew of untrained Shiluks, Nuas and Dinkas. Quite a task, but they did well. In November 1955, all British troops left the Sudan. Independence was imminent.